You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is Karen Kelt. Thanks for tuning in to Author Stories. We've got a fantastic show for you today. But before we get into that, I'd like to tell you about a couple of sponsors who make the show possible each and every day. Craig Allinson has a brand new book. It's a spinoff of the Expeditionary Force series, Expeditionary Force Mavericks, Book 1, Death Trap. The human soldiers stranded on the planet Paradise have been recruited into an alien legion to do the dirty jobs that the high-tech species won't do. Their first mission is to kick the enemy off a backwater planet no one cares about. It's a simple assignment, except everyone has a hidden agenda, and the planet could become a death trap. Craig Allinson's brand new book, Death Trap. Also thanks to Ernie Lindsay with his Sarah series, the psychological thriller series that begins with Sarah, has books 1-3 and a bonus novella, Single Mother, Successful Executive, Target for Revenge. The psychological thriller series box set, Sarah Winthrop's world is thrown headlong into a whirlwind of chaos along with her family, friends, and colleagues by unseen enemies seeking revenge. Those lurking in the shadows clawing for vengeance will go to any lengths. Any lengths. It's likely never occurred to them that they may have just messed with the wrong woman. The Sarah series. Books 1-3 and a bonus novella by Ernie Lindsay. Also, John L. Monk with The Jenkins Cycle. From Book 1, Kick, a supernatural thriller. They say suicides are damned for eternity, but if possessing the bodies of violent criminals is hell, then Dan Jenkins will take it. And he does. Every time a portal arrives to whisk him from his ghostly exile. Normally, before the villain returns to kick him out, Dan dishes out a final serving of justice and leaves the world a safer place. It's one of the rules if he wants more rides, and he's happy to oblige. For a part-time dead guy, it's a pretty good gig. And then he meets her. Kick is the first book in a series of supernatural thrillers. If you like Quantum Leap and Everyday, you'll love this gritty and original take on the body-hopping hero story. Vividly written, Kick is a wild ride with a sharp, sarcastic wit and a flawed, yet likable main character. From John L. Monk, The Jenkins Cycle, Book 1, Kick. And from M.D. Massey, Invasion, Zombie Apocalypse. The action-packed first novel in M.D. Massey's Them Zombie Apocalypse series. When a surprise nuclear attack forces Aiden from hiding, he finds the world to be a much different place and more deadly. Now he'll traverse a post-apocalyptic landscape populated by violent redneck looters, rogue military factions, and an army of hungry undead. After two combat tours in the Middle East, Aiden Sullivan just wants to be left alone on his family's ranch in the Texas Hill Country. But when the bombs fall and the dead walk, Aiden risks life and limb to rescue his aging parents from the zombie horde. To save them, he'll traverse half the state of Texas while fighting rogue military units, violent redneck looters, and thousands of walking dead. The question is, can he make it there in time? Only one thing's for sure, this ranger will complete the mission or he'll die trying. M.D. Massey's Invasion, Zombie Apocalypse. Now on to our show. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am super excited to have Karen Kelt on the show with me today. Karen has a new book that you guys, this book is going to blow your mind. It is fantastic. It's called The Parrot's Perch, a memoir. And I'm super excited to have you on the show today. Karen, welcome.
Thank you so much, Hank. I'm super excited to be here, too.
Well, Karen, we begin each show with the same question. And that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Oh, my gosh. First memory of wanting to be a writer, probably in high school. writing for the high school magazine that we had, poetry, and I remember being totally enthralled with poets at that point in time, actually. And so I guess it was a generational thing, listening to the music of the 60s, which is you know, when I was there, 60s in high school, and their lyrics and everything spoke to me, and I always thought, oh, how cool to be able to write like that.
No doubt. I've always been fascinated by songwriters as well. There's something magical about telling an entire story in, you know, 3.5 minutes that just, hits all the emotional notes.
It does. It's amazing how they do that, and it does, and it speaks to so many people, obviously, so...
Did you pursue any poetry or songwriting?
You know, just dabbling, like I said, for the school paper, and never did much more after that until years later, after I was in the States. And my story, I was born and raised in Brazil, so my story kind of started out there. And then years later, when I was living in the States, I did actually have a little newspaper column when we were living in the Carolinas. And so I always kind of had this inkling that at some point I would write, but never did anything really serious.
You have a very kind of neutral American accent. How long have you been in the States?
Well, I came in 1979. And I was born in Brazil in 1953, so I lived there for the first 27 years of my life. But my mom is American. She was from New York. And my dad had been born in Brazil, but he was educated in the States. So we spoke both languages when I was growing up.
Gotcha. What was Brazil like in the 60s and that whole time growing up there? What was it different than it is today? What was your experience there?
Well, you know, living in Brazil when I was little, and with the background and business that my father was involved in, I had a much different upbringing probably than a majority of the people. We had maids, we had chauffeurs. It was really a exclusive sort of a lifestyle. It was really very, very wonderful. But Brazil has always, in my memory, always had this sort of a dark undercurrent. When I was growing up, it was right at the time of the dictatorship, and then the government was overthrown. So even as a child, you know, we had armed guards, and my father carried weapons, and, you know, we had glass shards that topped the walls around our property. So even though I never personally felt, any kind of difficulties, it was always sort of out there that if you went beyond the wall, so to speak, you know, that you could be in dangerous territory. So, and it is different today. People, it's just, I don't know, it's a journey that we've watched Brazil go through, a time of being, you know, really on top of the world economically. They have so much to offer the world. They have so much accessible things like farming, agriculture, mining, industry. They have everything, but it's centered in two cities mainly. And the rest of the country is really fairly poverty-ridden. So we've seen a lot of corruption since I was a child, and it continues today, unfortunately.
Wow. So growing up like that, where you said you had a different experience than most Brazilians would have, and seemed to be kind of sequestered. Did you feel like an outsider there? Was it ever like that, or was that something you realized later in life? Oh, my experience was different than most people's.
Yeah, no, you know, interestingly, and I think because of the fact that my father was born in Brazil, and we had a very large family in Brazil, I sort of always felt like what I've come to learn today is a new term. It's called being a third culture kid, because we're sort of stuck between two cultures. And a lot of the kids that grew up with me that went to the American school, which I did, go to an American school for all 12 years from K through 12th grade, and then I went to a Brazilian university. But all of the kids whose fathers came because they worked for GM or Ford, or they were, you know, counselor or whatever they might have been, most of them didn't have that dual citizenship sort of background. And so I had hundreds of friends in both the American culture and in the Brazilian culture. And though I didn't feel like an outsider so much, I never really felt like I was 100% a part of either one of those.
Gotcha.
It's a strange place to be. You're sort of American. Brazilians considered me to be Brazilian, and Americans considered me to be American, but I was kind of something in between.
So you just kind of get pulled in all directions.
That's right.
So your book, The Parrot Perch, mm-hmm. is... It tells the story of, I kind of wanted you to give that background there so that okay. we could then kind of bridge over into where the book picks up. But before we get into that, in the introduction of the book, you thank Tom Petty. And, Tom Petty's kind of a hero of mine. And, I kind of laughed when I saw that. I was like, I think Karen's a kindred spirit. what is it about Tom Petty that you love so much?
Well, you know, it's like we were saying earlier, musicians' lyrics have always spoken to me, and Tom Petty in particular, because I was at a very low point in my life when I first heard his music. And it felt like he was speaking directly to me. And at that point, one of the first songs of his that I ever heard was Refugee. And I had just moved from Brazil. I had left everything that I'd known for the first 27 years of my life and moved to California, where I had no friends or family. And as I say, I was at a very low point in my life. And I remember driving home one night from work and listening to the lyrics of that song. And it kind of was a salvation for me.
Wow. Well, let's talk about where the book picks up. In the opening, you talk about in that first chapter that you tell people that you're from Carefree, and mm-hmm. They usually laugh and tell you how lucky you are. But then we start getting, I love that you start with that, because then we start going down a road with you that is an emotional journey. And to know that you wound up in a place called Carefree, is a miracle. Tell us how the story begins and what your experience was that brought you to the point of writing this book.
Okay. Well, first, people often will ask me, what is a parrot's perch? And I'll start off by telling you that it's a torture device. It's innocuous enough name, and it was used in Brazil originally by native Brazilians who would transport parrots that they found up in the Amazon and, you know, that they would bring to the big cities to sell. And so basically they would attach whatever the bird is that they had by its feet and hang it on this device that was called a parrot's perch and bring it to town. So I'm sure that just that image, is pretty evocative. But I, even though I had heard that name when I was growing up, and when I was a little older, you know, by the time I was in high school, I knew that there was a device that they used for torture in Brazil. but I'd never seen one, obviously. And so anyway, when I was in my early 20s, I started dating someone who I'd known pretty much all my life, who was also from an American family living in Brazil. And we were married on my 23rd birthday. And 4 months later, we ended up in a Brazilian prison. And for 45 days, we were beaten and tortured and raped. And that device, the parrot's perch, that's where I found out what it really is used for. And so that's that's why I left Brazil at the age of 27. Brazil passed a law that protected any of their officials, police, from being prosecuted if they tortured. And torture and jails with horrible, horrible human rights were commonplace in Brazil. It wasn't anything that people could complain about. If anybody complained about things like in Brazil, like that in Brazil, chances were that you would disappear. So when Brazil passed that law in 1979, which was just a couple of years after my husband and I were released, I knew that I couldn't live there any longer. And that's when I came to the United States. And you know, it was one of those situations. And actually, just the other day, I was in the car listening again to music, which really speaks to me. And I heard the song "Augustana," I think it of Augustana, Boston, and it's about somebody making a new start in Boston. And, you know, that's what I felt I had to do. I had to leave this place that was my home, where all of my friends and family were, and I couldn't live there any longer. And I couldn't tell anybody what happened to me. I never really got into that. And, you know, I was either embarrassed or afraid that I would be judged, or you know, that people would kind of go, "Oh God, she's been tortured. You know, we don't want to talk about that kind of stuff." And so basically for 30 years, I didn't talk about it. I didn't tell anyone what I had experienced. And I was just this person who showed up one day in California and started a new life. And then, well, of course, I got married in the interim, and I did got remarried. I'm sorry, I did, of course, tell my husband to be, you know, what had happened and why I had ended up in the States. But I never gave any details. We never really talked about the actual time that my husband and I were in jail for 45 days. We didn't discuss any of that. And so I think it was just all inside me, even though I thought that I had let it go and that I had started a new life, that was still always a part of me and what had happened. And of course, I also followed politics in Brazil very closely. And one of the things that happened in Brazil, and this was in 2013, 2012, Brazil started, the president of Brazil appointed a committee called the National Truth Committee, which is similar to what they did in South Africa with the apartheid. And they started this committee that was going to investigate human rights violations in Brazil during the period that I had been taken and during the dictatorship. And so at that point in time, I decided that if it would be helpful to anyone else, that I would participate in that investigation. And I was invited to give my testimony at the Truth Commission. So that's where the book begins, really. You know, as you said, it starts with me in Carefree, but then I go to New York and I testify before the Truth Commission at Brazil's permanent mission to the UN. And, you know, I give all the details of what happened and why it happened and or why I thought it happened. And from there, you know, the investigation sort of continued and expanded.
So let me ask you this. Let's turn back the clock a little bit to the time when you and your husband were abducted and spent 45 days being tortured and imprisoned. You know, we say stuff like that, and it's just almost impossible to comprehend the weight, the gravity of just, you know, you say it and it just, it doesn't carry the weight that it should. What was going on when you guys were abducted? And did you have any idea this was happening? Did someone just break in? Like how did that happen?
Yeah, we'd just been married 4 months earlier. So we were in our honeymoon phase, and my husband and I had gone to sleep. And I know today what time it was because I was later told that at around 3 o'clock in the morning, we were awoken by our housekeeper, and he came to the bedroom door, which in itself was, you know, just completely unusual, and started, you know, asking my husband to get up and saying that there was somebody there that needed to see us. And of course, we both woke up and were, you know, completely startled and were, you know, not aware of anything that was going on. And four men just brushed past our housekeeper and came into the bedroom and turned all the lights on and began, you know, yelling at us to get out of bed and, you know, made us get dressed in front of them and started accusing us of being drug dealers. And, you know, that was the farthest thing from any kind of reality. And at first, you know, at first my reaction was to say, oh, you know, and stupidly, because I've always been a little bit bold, I guess, and, you know, always felt that nothing could hurt me. And so I immediately accused them of being liars. And the guy held up a bat. I said, you're bandits. That sort of thing was common in Brazil for not necessarily home invasions, but claiming to be police and breaking into people's homes to steal. You never really heard of them killing anybody, so I don't think I was afraid of that. But I thought they were thieves. And so one of them held up a badge, and I said, oh, that's a fake. You can get that anywhere. That's just a fake. And at that point, he came to my side of the bed, and he put his gun to my temple and said, this isn't a fake. Get out of bed. And so at that point, I was terrified. And from that point forward, I think for the next 45 days, I was terrified. But we were taken from our home. They had all of the servants outside, and they watched us. And as we left, you know, we yelled to them to please call my parents and my brother and let them know what was going on. And we were sure that, you know, we would be released immediately, that it was a big mistake or that it was a bribe situation, and that once the bribe was paid, you know, we would be fine. And as we left, we had a very long uphill driveway, and as we left the driveway, we were very terrified to have seen on the side of the driveway we had two guard dogs, and they had been obviously poisoned and were both laying dead at the side of the driveway. And that's when we both, I think, realized that, oh my gosh, this is more than, you know, a robbery. This is more than a bribe. Something else is going on. And so we were taken, and both, you know, I was crying and my husband was trying to comfort me, and we were begging them, telling them we'd pay them whatever they wanted. And they kept saying, oh, it's too late, you don't have enough money, you know, things like that. And then we were taken to the prison. And again, they told us that they were going to arrest us for being drug traffickers. They took our pictures and took fingerprints, but they never charged us with anything. And then they just told us that we were going to have to wait until, you know, somebody came on our behalf. And from that, we understood that they were looking for a bribe.
Wow. So were these government officials? Were these bandits? Did you kind of find out their true identity?
Yeah, we did. They were actually police officers. And they were just in it for a bribe. And of course, you know, this was 1976. So in 1976, there is no such thing as instant bank wiring. There's no such thing as, you know, transferring funds overseas easily. And so initially they asked for $1 million is what they asked for. And that was absurd. But the amount of money that we ended up paying, which was $400,000, was a huge amount of money. And it had to be, you know, secured. And at first we thought that it could be, my husband was the grandson of a New York State senator. And he had quite a large family trust. And initially we thought that we could get the money from the family trust. And unfortunately, the bankers of a New York bank, which I won't give away right now, they said that they would not be involved in any kind of bribes or whatever, and they declined to pay the money. So, you know, again, that was one of the reasons why everything took so long, is because at first we tried to get the money from the family trust. Then we tried to get money on the outside. My father was working on this, and my husband's attorney was working on it. And of course, we didn't know what was going on. We had no idea why nobody had come to set us free. We only found out later. And so what had happened was they were trying to get the money from the trust, and then my father had tried to get money, which he had in a Swiss bank account, and eventually that's where the money came from. But at the time, we had no idea.
And you're going through this for 45 days, just not knowing from moment to moment, from day to day, what your fate is going to be.
Exactly.
And I understand that this was just a continuous physical abuse, obviously, which is maybe what we think about is the most horrible thing on the surface, and of course it's horrible. But the emotional games and abuse going on had to be the thing that made maybe the most lasting effect. Is that true?
Yes, absolutely. The mental anguish of not knowing, we were separated, of course, my husband and I were separated. And, you know, not knowing what was happening to him and not knowing if, you know, today would be the day they would kill us, or, you know, not knowing if I would ever see my family again was horrific. And on top of that, in the beginning, the first few days that we were there, we were still actually together for just about three days, and they made us watch them torture an individual, and I believe they killed him. Of course, you know, we don't know that, but it was definitely horrific. And you know, I think when I try to think about the whole situation and how I survived, mostly I was, you know, I was just not really 100% there. My brain, you know, went somewhere else, and I was just a shell of a human, I think. And oh my gosh, the food was just horrific. I don't think I ate pretty much hardly anything the whole time I was there. And so I had also gotten quite ill, and they had to take me to a hospital. And as it turned out, that when they did that for blood transfusions, because I had lost a lot of blood, that happened to be the day before the funds were finally transferred and we were released.
Wow. I don't want to give away all the details because I want people to get their own copy of The Parrot's Perch, but you were released and you came to a point not long after that where you had to leave. This was just too much to deal with. And you wind up in the States and you start over. I mean, from scratch, right?
Exactly.
And, I'm sure that, the group of people that you confided in, and I mean really confided in, was probably very small.
There was no one. I didn't confide in anyone. Brazil, as a woman in 1979, which is when I left, you can't leave a country. You can't leave the country if you're married without having specific permission to leave. And I didn't have that. And I knew that if I told anyone that I was planning to leave, I would be stopped. So I didn't. My parents didn't know. Nobody knew for 2 years after I left where I even was. And I was terrified when I left that I would get sort of yanked back at the airport and thrown back in jail because what I was doing was basically illegal.
So the story of The Parrot's Perch is really the story of you rebuilding and not just rebuilding, but repairing and going through the process of healing, this horrific thing that none of us can, I can't even wrap my head around, the level of abuse and torture and then, you know, not only that, but then the lasting effects that you go through. And this really is a story of, it's really a testament to the human spirit and what we can go through and how we can come away from that. Talking with people that have been victims of abuse and that have these amazing stories to tell, one thing, because the rest of us cannot wrap our heads around it, it's so easy for us, the person that did not go through it, to try to comfort the person that did go through it. And because we have no frame of reference, it makes us very uncomfortable. And we would like for that person to just, get over it and move on. And not from an insensitive point of view. We just don't want to see someone suffer.
Absolutely.
And I would assume that you got lots of that from probably well-meaning people that when people did find out what happened to you. But it's not that easy, is it?
And as I said, basically for me, and it's very interesting because I did hold all this inside for close to 30 years. And what woke me up, believe it or not, that I couldn't keep this inside because I knew I had issues for the 30 years. You know, I tried to live as normal a life as possible, but obviously there were times when I was either super angry or, you know, just doing stupid things. And so I knew that something had to change, and especially as I grew older. But one thing that I that I do, a lot of people ask me about, how did you survive all that stuff? And one thing that I've come to learn, and I believe this, is that we, every single one of us, it's almost like we have an extra sense beyond hearing and seeing and taste and smell and all that. I think that we all have an extra power, if you will, you know, not like a superhero power, but we all have an untapped ability to achieve whatever we want to. And it, if you look at something like that up in the dictionary, I suppose it would say determination. But it goes a little bit beyond determination because it's like you have to believe in yourself. And I think that in my particular case, I think that's what got me through, is that I was so stubborn and I was so determined not to let anyone beat me, that that's how, you know, how I survived the whole thing. But what got me to the point where I decided to write about it was actually yoga. And I was in a yoga class, and I don't know if you or your listeners are familiar with that, but after, at the end of a yoga class, you typically have something called savasana, where you just lay on the ground with your eyes closed, and the teacher usually talks a little bit about whatever the theme of the class might have been. And you never know what that's going to be, really, you know, what she's going to talk about until the end of the class. And so she said these words, and she said, "Forgiveness is letting go of the hope that your past could ever be any different." And that just hit me, and I almost sat up in class, and I thought, okay, you've let all this stuff go. But I did always wonder why this had happened. Why me? How? You know, what was the reason? And always sort of hoped, I guess, that that hadn't happened to me. But the reality was that it did. And so that day after class, I came home and I basically collapsed and cried and figured that the only thing that would ever let me release this was if I did talk about it and write. And so that's what I did. I wrote a first version of my book in 3 days.
Wow.
And it just all poured out.
That is amazing.
And yeah, and then of course it took, you know, obviously years to get it,
of course,
to where it would be published and everything else. But
having that first draft, you had something then to work with.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So when you decided to write that and it started pouring out, did you ever envision this being a book that other people would read, or was this something that you just needed to do to bring some light into the darkness?
Yeah, no, I never really did. It was just sort of meant to be a cathartic thing. It was just a release. I just needed to get rid of, you know, everything that had happened. And so, no, I never really did envision it. It just sort of expanded, and it kept happening. And then the very strange thing that happened was my husband and I were on vacation. My current husband and I were on vacation, and we ran into a well-known gentleman by the name of Steve Mosco and his wife. And he was, though I didn't know it at the time when we met them, I only met them knowing their first names. Turned out he was at the time CEO of Sony Pictures. And we were chatting one afternoon, and somehow corruption came up in our conversation. And I said, oh, I know all about corruption. And so I ended up telling him and his wife the story. And he said to me, well, give me your information, because in a couple of days I'm going to have somebody from my office call you. And I never believed that for a minute. I thought, oh, yeah, right. And so I went home, and sure enough, within a week, I got a call from Sony Pictures, and they optioned my story But then at that point, this was in 2015, he had been the chairman and CEO of Sony while the whole Sony hack thing was going on. And he ended up resigning or was fired, and that was the end of it. They kept the option for 2 years, but then they released it in 2017. So yeah, those sorts of things happen. People, you know, I started talking about it first with all my yoga friends and then close friends, and then everybody wanted to hear more and more and more. And so then finally it's gotten to this point where I wrote it as a memoir, because the first version had actually been fictional at that time, because I was very afraid that there could be some retaliation from Brazil if I ever really did tell the true story. And so it was then that the Truth Commission happened, and they invited me to testify, and they started doing investigation in Brazil, and I started doing investigation in the United States, and we found out what we think is the real reason why we were taken.
Wow. Yeah. And we're going to save all those juicy details for folks to read for themselves. But as you start writing this book and shaping it into memoir, did you feel empowered at any point that you, like we talked about earlier, you're bringing some light into the darkness? Does there become a point where you transition from telling details to I now kind of take control of the situation for myself, and maybe I can help others to do the same? You know, is there a switch from victim to what's the word I'm looking for, to champion?
Well, I still kind of balk a little bit at that word champion. But there was definitely a switch where I was able to say, okay, I own this. And it did come. I was scared to death to testify at the Truth Commission, to be perfectly honest, because when I do talk about it, it brings up so many vivid feelings and emotions that it's very difficult still for me to talk about it. But when I finished at the Truth Commission, I, you know, remembered thinking to myself, if this, my story can help bring an end to what still was going on then in Brazil, it was totally worth it. And I've spoken at our local library, and I've spoken to a few people, and I was very surprised to have women come up to me and say, you know, thank you for telling that story, you know, talking about being raped, because I was raped too, and I was afraid to talk about it, you know, is what one young woman came. And to me, that was how I was speaking at Amnesty International here in Phoenix, Arizona. And this young woman came up to me and she said, you gave me, you know, the strength to talk about it myself. And so that, to me, was another sort of an aha moment that really made it worth going through it all again to if any one person could be helped. And obviously it's not over, because Brazil is still, as I said earlier, in chaos, and the Truth Commission was unable to accomplish much of anything with their report. And so my hope is that, you know, that somehow our government here in the U.S. or someplace, you know, in the world, Brazil will get the message that this type of human rights abuse is just not, it's just not right.
Right.
And it has to stop.
And it's the power of stories that help to bring those things about. We can we can talk about facts and statistics, but until we see the human impact of things and people sharing those, with honesty, that change happens. And it's books like yours that help to instigate those things.
Yeah. And that's the hope. You know, 2,000 people, were interviewed by that Truth Commission. And of course, you know, there are just as many thousand people who disappeared and are no longer with us that are unable to testify. And as I said, it still goes on today. So if people, and I realize that now, if people do talk about it and raise awareness that this kind of situation is going on, hopefully it can be a change.
Excellent. Well, the book is called The Parrot's Perch. Karen, this has been a fascinating conversation. I want to talk to you all day and get to it, but I really want people to go out and get their copy of the Parrot's Perch. This is a memoir that reads like a novel. And you're doing fantastic work. We really wish you success on the book. If people are just learning about you and want to find out more about you, is there a place where they can look you up and maybe find out more about you and connect with you online?
Yes, I do have a Facebook author page, which is The Parrot's Perch. And I also have a website, and it's www.theparrotsperch.com. But I will say that today it is under construction right at this moment. So it's being fixed up a little bit, and it'll be available very soon. So those are the two ways that people could reach me. And I'm available through SparkPoint Press Publicity. If anyone would like me to speak at a book club or anything like that, I can talk a little bit about my book.
Fantastic. Karen, it has been a great pleasure to talk with you today. We're going to send everybody to see you and to get a copy of the book. I'm going to have links to it in the show notes. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
All right, Hank. Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for listening to the Author Stories Podcast. For more great author interviews like this one, go to hankgarner.com and dig through the archives. There's something there I know you'll love. Now stay tuned for a special audio clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
You took a terrible risk tonight.
Why?
You don't know? The first rule.
I was told by a friend that I shouldn't reveal my gift to anyone who doesn't have a gift themselves.
That's exactly right.
Because everyone we tell dies.
Yes. You might have marked me for death.
Made you a target for a ghost. Why can't people know what we can do? What makes it so dangerous? Valerie took up the fireplace prongs and stabbed the logs.
It's called the Great Curse.
Sparks exploded from glowing crevices and drizzled upwards, ricocheting off the black belly of the cauldron, turning into tiny ashes that disappeared up the chimney.
It was cast by a powerful witch over 300 years ago.
Witch? Sorry, but witch? Please, there's no such thing. Valerie closed her eyes. A spoon leapt from Jason's dish and caught him in the temple. He wiped melted ice cream from his cheek. You were saying?
She cast the curse to stop the witch trials.
In Salem? Jason searched his memory. 1690...
1692. They burned her alive in the Salem Common. The only witch to be burned.
The cauldron smoked slightly. Its contents had evaporated. A sharp, charred scent filled the room. Wait, said Jason. There were no witches. They were just, I don't know, victims of religious hysteria, right? So you're saying the witch trials were justified?
Justified? So if a witch did exist, it would be okay To kill her?
No, I just thought... You're right, never mind.
There was one witch in Salem, at least. A woman with a powerful gift. She only wanted to protect people like us. To give the gifted their anonymity, refuge. She cast the Great Curse as she burned. She proclaimed that mortals who know a witch shall know death. And that is the Great Curse. And it's still in effect after all this time.
Mortal, as in?
Non-gifted. No mortal can know about you, about any authentic witch.
Jason winced. Isn't there another word besides that? She shrugged. So no one can know what I am, what I can do, or else they become a target.
Right. The spirit world will obey the Great Curse and try to kill them.
The spirit world.
The other realm.
Jason rubbed his eyes. How much of this was reality and how much of this was Valerie's nutty brand of mysticism? He felt himself pulling back, as usual, for fear of contagion. He'd spent his whole life reading science fiction. He hated paranormal tales. This was not his genre.